Nikki Bush is here. It's 8 minutes after eight. It's Weekend Breakfast. My name is Pimelo Motene. We've already started this conversation, believe it or not, because as she walked in, I said, let's talk now, not 10 minutes time, not 5 minutes time.
Nothing like hijacking me, Pimelo.
There's a lot to discuss. Okay, so what we're discussing today is ease of learning. Very, very contested terminology there, because I don't think there is such a thing as easy learning, but ease of learning. Okay. Nikki Bush, should learning be easy? Is there such a thing as easy learning?
Pimelo, it is such a, as I say, controversial. We were talking about it before we went on air, a bit of a controversial point. Because in our busyness, in our lack of time with children, it seems that learning is becoming more difficult, and we want to keep our children happy and we want to make life easy because we don't have time for meltdowns. We don't have time for extra anything.
Failure.
Okay. Or failure or meltdowns or anything like that. And teachers are coming up against children who don't have resilience and resourcefulness a lot more. So it's actually easier for them to make learning in the classroom easier as well. But the interesting thing is that when learning is too easy, it's often more superficial and not as deep. Now, let's maybe change our terminology from easy to interesting, or from difficult to interesting. We don't want learning to be so difficult that it's a turnoff. We don't want children to give up on learning because it's so hard. But we do want to make learning interesting. And if learning's interesting, we pique their curiosity and they want to come back for more. Okay. There is something called the learning pit. And the learning pit is, if you can Google it, it's a concept where you get to the, you get to a point in learning, and it, this is being applied to children, and teachers are going on courses about the learning pit. So if you imagine a child is learning a concept, okay, and usually you take a child from something they know to another step harder, something they don't know. So if you imagine they come to the edge of a cliff, they know something, and then you give them another something to learn, and suddenly they go, oops, this isn't so easy. And now they start down on the slippery slope, and imagine a pit, a U, in front of them, a U. And they start going down the U because now they have to learn something they didn't know before, or they don't grasp quite so easily. So now they're going down the, oh, maybe I don't know it. Oh, maybe I need to ask a few more questions. Maybe I need to try this. Maybe I need to try that. And you see my hands moving and I'm going
upward.
I'm going down the pit and up the other side. Now, we entered the pit at this level. By the time we've gone down the U, and if we've learned well, and through personal experience, preferably, we should come up at a higher level
than where you entered the pit.
The ground level should be higher than where we entered. That's the ideal learning pit. So we gain our confidence in the concept or the ideology or whatever it is, and we come out the other side and we go, I did it. Now, this doesn't have to just be in the classroom.
Yes, of course.
So when you first started on air, for example, you were first a producer, because I've known you for that long, that you were behind the scenes. And then you started in front of the microphone. And that must have been like being at the edge of a learning pit. And then as you learned, you came out higher and higher and higher and got better and more proficient at your skills. So this applies to the way the brain learns, the way we all learn. It's no different for a child than it is for an adult. But when we're children, when we have children, we have to lead them often through the learning process. And it's in the leading, the facilitating of the learning process that the skill lies. So we really need, and that's why we need skilled educators, you know, skilled educators who can take our children along this pathway. So very often, what we're trying to do is prepare the path for our child. And if you look, if you take a pathway, say through a forest, okay, we want to take all the obstacles away. We actually want a pathway that is clearly defined. We want to be able to see the path. Can we see that thousands of people walked on this path before us, that it's clear of all vegetation? That's kind of where we think learning should be. But when you look at this learning pit scenario, clever teachers and clever parents actually strategically place fallen logs on this pathway for children to climb over and walk around to discover how their own learning and how their own brains work.
That's a fantastic scenario. However, we've got time problems here. We've allocated a year to a child to get in at one level of the pit and to come out higher at that pit in a restricted amount of time. And we all know not all children are going to discover at the same pace.
You raise a really, really interesting point, because that is true. And our whole system is set up to cater to children learning at the same pace, learning the same things at the same time, grasping things at the same time. And that is probably one of the biggest flaws of the traditional education system, which is why we are seeing a huge resurgence of interest in things like Geno-Plan schools, Waldorf systems, Montessori systems, Reggio Emilia philosophies. Now, you cannot be a Reggio Emilia school. You cannot be a Montessori school. It's actually a philosophy that you ascribe to, that you follow. It's not even a curriculum. It's a philosophy where you understand that children learn at different rates, and children learn best when they follow their interest. So we're looking at philosophies that are more child-directed now than curriculum-directed. Now, obviously, this is going to take a very, very long time to find its way into mainstream schools. But I go to conferences, education conferences, often, and there are more and more conferences where the mainstream schools, teachers from mainstream schools, are attending conferences around these different philosophies, which introduce the concept of the fact that children have their own natural developmental learning timetable. There are arguments as to whether we should have children of all the same age in the same class.
Yes.
So, in some systems like Waldorf, for example, they do have children who are all the same ages, but they also mix. They mix children a lot. In Montessori schools, they mix children a lot. You might not have just four-year-olds in a class. You might have 3 to 5 year-olds in a class, because what you find when there's a group of children, and this is, as I said, experiments are being done in mainstream schools now to test this. When you have different age ranges in a class, one child knows something that another child doesn't learn. Mm. Children are very good at collaborating. Mm. Now, collaboration is one of those words that's coming up big time in the world of work. The world of work is saying we need kids to come out of school with collaborative skills, who can work in a team. We need critical thinking skills. We need problem-solving skills. Now, if learning's too easy, they won't learn critical thinking skills and problem-solving skills. And if
leadership skills,
absolutely. Yeah. Now, put a group of kids together who are different at different ages and stages, and you will see leadership coming out. You will see the effect of what we call holacracy. Holacracy is something being implemented in the workplace right now, where a project is given to a team. The team consists of 23-year-olds to 53-year-olds. The 53-year-old is probably, by virtue of the fact of the system, the leader of the team. Okay. But if that 53-year-old has half a brain and knows their team well, their strengths, their weaknesses, their talents, who's good at what, and this project comes to the team, if they implement what we call holacracy, which means that you don't go according to hierarchy, you don't dish out the tasks according to hierarchy, you actually dish out the tasks according to skills level. If the 23-year-old has the skill that is required for some major part of this project, you give it to the 23-year-old. And you share out the tasks according to kind of best practice, not according to the hierarchy or the age or anything like that. And it's a very interesting way to run a team, because you should actually get the best results, because nobody should be in it for ego. They're in it for what they're good at. And you're matching skills to what is required in the project. So you take ego out of the picture and you match the best person to that part of the project. And you see this happening with children as well. When you have them in these mixed groups, and even in family groups, like you've got all the cousins together, together on a family holiday. You have cousins together of, you know, young ones to old ones, all in a group. And if you watch through the keyhole or the crack in the door and there's no adult in the room, you watch them organize themselves.
Absolutely.
You watch them match the best person for what's required right now, whether it is creeping out of a window onto a rooftop, or whether it's stealing a cookie from the jar, or whether it is building a tower of something with all the building blocks and whatever. They actually share the task, and they do it wisely. The minute you put an adult in that group, everything goes to pot, because suddenly there's a competition for time and attention. Suddenly people are competing to show up, to show off in front of this adult.
Should you be concerning yourself about boundaries? So, you know, where the school says, or the philosophy says, well, let's allow the child to develop and grow and learn at their own pace. Should that be what you should be allowing to happen? Or should you also be pushing for further growth at a much, much more accelerated pace than the child would allow? Is there a balance there?
I think there is a balance, and I think we do need both. And that's why we do need a guide alongside. We're moving away from the teacher and the parent being the sage on the stage, the all-knowing gatekeeper of all knowledge. We're now moving to a point where adults are now the guide alongside, because if we can access all the world's information, what is the learning process all about? It's about facilitating that learning. And there is a balance between things being easy, and they usually become easy because we repeat them so often that it becomes normal, and then giving a child something new, which is always a challenge. So it's a bit of a push me, pull you kind of thing. And I'd like to put something else on the table here. And we see it particularly in the technology industry, that design is iterative, that products are iterative, that we put products on the market today before they are perfect. Cell phones are never perfect. They put version whatever out, okay, and they leave it for the users, the public, to find the bugs in the system, to alert the manufacturers, who then debug the system and send out a new software update. Okay. Now, children are quite similar. And maybe we need to be helping our children with some different terminology, that when they come up against a brick wall, a blockage, something difficult, something maybe they're really battling with, we need to talk to them maybe about debugging their own learning system instead of, we have a problem. You know, I think so much of our terminology is at the heart of the issue. And of course, as you mentioned right at the beginning of the interview, not fitting in exactly to the right timetable of learning. And in traditional schooling, there is very little gap for maneuver there, because the minute you're not on track, you either get extra work, which sometimes does the trick. Okay, you get extra work, or you get mum or dad get called in, and here's some exercises that you can do to, and the word will be to reinforce what we're learning in the classroom. If the learning gap becomes too wide, then you're going to be called in and you're going to be told a couple of extra lessons, or putting your child into remedial for a month or two or a year or three is going to close the learning gap. Which, when children are very young, actually remediation works very well. But once again, we go back to a philosophical approach here. So this is the intellectual approach. Now we go back to the philosophical approach. Do we believe that our children should all be learning at the same pace? And this is a question that schools are actually addressing.
So if we take our lead from the child, we also know that children have different personalities. Not necessarily capabilities, but personalities. In other words, you can have a super smart child, but who's also very very driven and resistant to challenge. So that could be a combination where not knowing can be a resistance to learning. Mm. So because they're super sharp, they don't like that cliff.
Mm.
They don't like being thrown into a situation where they've got to maneuver because they actually enjoy being the winner, right? So the pace is likely to be guided by that child differently if you allow them to dictate the pace. So then that brings me to, how then do you manage that? You know, I know somebody whose child was, I think, I don't know, 10, 11, who said to me, my child has only started reading now.
Mm.
She doesn't believe there's anything wrong with the child. She doesn't believe there's anything, you know, there's nothing wrong with them intellectually. There's nothing wrong with them. But the system has allowed them to decide when it's time to learn reading. And I kind of cringed at 11 and 10.
As most modern people would, because we are geared to thinking our children should learn to read by 7. If you were in the UK, however, your child would be reading at 4. Depends what you're exposed to and depends what the expectations are. If you look at the UK system, kids are often burnt out by the age of 7 or 8 because they had to learn so much that maybe is not in line with the way the brain actually unfolds and evolves.
Mm.
There is a lot more focus now on teaching children in a way that is friendly to the way the brain actually works.
Mm.
Remember, school has been a construct of the Industrial Revolution where we needed kids to be on a production line saying, yes, ma'am,
of
no,
course.
No, the sir, three bags. Yeah,
yes.
Three bags full, sir.
Yes.
Being obedient, being punctual, all knowing how to write in the same way so it was legible so we could be in administrative clerk type jobs or being in a production line. So it was a social construct at one stage. And if you looked at kids coming off the farms, their literacy rates were very, very high because they were being taught at their own pace and through example.
Experiencing
and parents interacting. Remember, parents had a lot of time in those days.
Mm-hmm.
We have to accept that as broken as we may think that the education system is, and as much as we would like to put our children into a system where they could all learn at their own pace, in their own style, etc., that is an incredibly big ask that requires of it incredibly smart educators, okay, who have had incredibly different training to a lot of the training that our educators sit with right now. So schools that are taking on new philosophies based on how children learn, more child-directed learning, are needing to attract very, very smart educators who are very whole-brained thinkers themselves. And I think we have a massive shortage of those kind of educators.
Well, what happens when you have a 2-year-old? You don't know what you don't know as
exactly.
a parent, right? How do you then make the call? What's best for them?
It's a very, very tricky thing. I think choosing a school today is probably one of
the most difficult things
that you can absolutely do.
Yeah.
Because we have choice. You know, in days gone by when I was at school,
there was no option.
And if you went to a private school, it was because your parents were stinking rich and there were very few of those. Now we have this big middle class with private schools accessible to the middle class, which means you can choose one of 5 or 6 or 7 schools in, you know, within proximity to you. And that puts you in a big conundrum. And not just that, you could possibly choose a school with a very different philosophy too.
That's it. Yeah.
And I think it's really worth visiting schools, seeing what's out there, and asking them not just, so what technology do you have and tell me about your sports fields, but what is your fundamental philosophy and approach towards how children learn? How do you understand the learning process? I think that's the right kind of question to be asking. And what kind of courses do your teachers go on? What kind of courses do they go on for continued professional development? That will give you a clue as to how the school thinks about educating your child, because education of a child goes way beyond the facilities of a school, beyond what you can see.
But there's also merit in knowing your child. Totally. Knowing your child.
Because you can also give the teacher insight into how your child learns. I'm also a huge fan, and maybe we can deal with this in another show.
Oh my gosh, I can't believe we've run out of time.
Yeah. Genetic brain dominance profiling of your child to give you insight into how your child's brain works, which is a very different thing to a lot of the other profiling techniques, but that's for another day.
I love that. I think we've run out of time, but let's quickly try and do this.
Right, so I have got Happy Birds here as the toy of the week, and it's a wooden game. It's all about matching, and it's magnetic. You saw me building it when I came in. So these birds are sitting on a little wooden bench, and they've got tails, and they've got bodies, they've got wings, and they've got faces. And it comes with these lovely matching cards, and you can see there are eight different cards, and you've got to build your magnetic wooden birds differently depending on what you see. So it's from 2D to 3D. Yes. It's copying. Now, copying skills are very important because children ultimately are going to work off a blackboard, a whiteboard, a smart board, books to paper, iPads to books, and vice versa. So this is a copying game to get your child working from 2D to 3D, so from a flat surface into 3D. They actually find it fascinating because magnets are fascinating. It's pattern matching as well.
Textile is wonderful thing.
Yeah, it is. It's all about taking visual instructions and putting them into practice. And when your child's not playing with matching cards, they can actually be doing free play with all these little birdies. And if you go onto Google and you look up Happy Birds, there's a lovely video of watching these twins who are about age 3 playing with this game and having to make decisions about what color wing and what color body. Yeah. It's actually more difficult than you think until you get the hang of it. And this is for about 3 years of age, 3 to 5. And it would be for 1 to 2 players. You could definitely have 2 kids playing with this at once. It's not a competitive game. It's a construction game. It's called Happy Birds by GoGo, G-O-G-O. And it's available at greenbeanlearningresources.co.za or on takealot.com.
Nikki Bush.